3. Feet to the fire, Pope in the sky. Soccer with Sakono. In March 1956, the new leader of the Soviet Union, Nikita Khrushchev, shocked the communist world. In an initially secret speech to the Communist Party, he issued a lengthy, unflinching denunciation of crimes committed by Stalin. Stalin had been unprepared for World War II, he claimed. He tortured his own comrades and forced them into confessing to crimes they had never committed as an excuse to have them shot and secure his grip on power. Stalin had died just 3 years earlier. When he did, so many people rushed toward his funeral procession that some were crushed. At the time, many citizens of the Soviet Union and other communist countries felt real affection for the man and a deep identification with the collectivist socialist project overall. To hear him attacked by the leader of the world's foremost Marxist-Leninist party, no less, was an unexpected blow to communists around the world. Some leftists, especially in Western Europe, reacted by distancing themselves from the Soviet project altogether. Others, most notably Mao, accused Khrushchev of distorting or exaggerating Stalin's misdeeds for his own benefit. He began to claim Khrushchev was guilty of the crime of revisionism of Marxist-Leninist doctrine, the first crack in a growing split between the two countries. Under its new leader, the Soviet Union pursued peaceful coexistence with the West, warmed to non-aligned countries, and expanded its aid to third-world countries like Indonesia, Egypt, India, and Afghanistan. Officially, the PKI went along with Khrushchev into a post-Stalinist, more moderate future. But in practice, the communist world was even more divided than it had been at the beginning of the Cold War. The Indonesian communists, confident in the importance of their country and growing in size and strength, were even more certain than before that they didn't need to take orders from abroad. After the failed Madiun uprising in 1948, the PKI had reorganized under the leadership of D.N. Aidit. Self-confident and gregarious, Aidit was born off the coast of Sumatra into a devout Muslim family and became a Marxist during Japan's occupation. With Aidit as its leader, the PKI transformed into a mass-based, legal, ideologically flexible movement that rejected the armed struggle, frequently ignored Moscow's directions, stuck close to Sukarno, and embraced electoral politics. The party was doing things very differently from the Russian or the Chinese communist parties. The PKI's goal, both publicly and privately, was to form an anti-feudal, united national front with the local bourgeoisie, and not to worry about implementing socialism until the end of the century. Internationally, the PKI was committed to anti-imperialism, and locally, party members were growing their movement by winning democratic elections. As 1956 progressed, the communist world was divided further when Khrushchev sent tanks into Hungary to crush an uprising and reassert Soviet control. The violence of October and November 1956 was a public relations debacle for Moscow. It was also a deep personal failure for Frank Wisner. Though the U.S. denied this publicly, the CIA had been encouraging the Hungarians to revolt, and many did so thinking they would receive support from Washington. When the Dulles brothers decided against this course of action, seemingly hanging the protesters out to dry, Wisner felt personally betrayed. His behavior became increasingly erratic. William Colby, a senior CIA officer in Rome, said in 1956 that Wisner was rambling and raving, totally out of control. He kept saying, "All these people are getting killed." His son noticed that he appeared overworked and was deeply emotionally involved in the events in Europe. Wiz began acting in ways the people working with him had a hard time understanding. They thought it might have been because of an illness caused by a bad plate of clams he had in Greece. While Second World communism was suffering from fissures, the Third World was further united by a bit of First World bumbling. After Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal, France and Britain invaded, against Washington's wishes, to reassert control of the waterway and oust the Egyptian leader. They were joined by the young state of Israel, whose creation had been supported by both Washington and Moscow, and eventually had to back down because of U.S. pressure. Despite Eisenhower's anger with the new Jewish state, Washington steadily increased support for Israel from the middle of the 1950s for Cold War reasons. It was the nascent alliances between the USSR and radical Arab nationalist regimes we know now that formed the basis for a growing US-Israel alliance. Something else happened in 1956, or rather, it didn't happen. The division between North and South Vietnam was supposed to be resolved by an election that would unite the country under a single government, but Ngo Dinh Diem, the Catholic leader of majority Buddhist South Vietnam, whom the United States had handpicked before he turned out to be hopelessly corrupt and dictatorial, knew that he would lose badly to Ho Chi Minh, so Diem decided to cancel the vote. Washington went along with this, just as it did when Diem fraudulently declared he had won an election in 1955 with 98.2% of the vote. From that moment on, the government in North Vietnam and many communists in the South believed they had the right to directly oppose Diem's US-backed regime. In the same turbulent year, Sukarno went to Washington. It's not clear whether or not the Indonesian leader himself knew this, but the visit did not go well. The impression he made with the most powerful people on the planet was not a good one. Back home in Indonesia, Sukarno's sexual appetites were famous, but they shocked the Americans. John Foster Dulles, a deeply prudish Presbyterian, found him disgusting. Frank Wisner, who usually didn't take his work home with him, confided to his son that Sukarno wanted to make sure his bed was properly filled, and the agency was not without the ability to satisfy the Indonesian ruler's lust. To make things worse, he went from Washington straight to Moscow and Beijing. He believed this his right as an independent world leader, of course, but this was not the kind of thing the Eisenhower administration tolerated. In the fall of 1956, Wisner told Al Ulmer, head of the CIA's Far East Division, "I think it's time we held Sukarno's feet to the fire." In elections the following year, the Indonesian Communist Party did even better than it had in 1955. The PKI was the most efficient, professional organization in the country. Crucially, in a country plagued with corruption and patronage, it had a reputation for being the cleanest of all the major parties. Its leaders were disciplined and dedicated, and Howard Jones saw quickly that they actually delivered on what they promised, especially to peasants and the poor. Jones was not the only one in the U.S. government who understood why the communists kept winning. The vice president at the time, Richard Nixon, gave voice to the general feeling in Washington when he said that a democratic government was probably not the best kind for Indonesia because the communists could probably not be beaten in election campaigns because they were so well organized. And most importantly, Jones recognized that the PKI was going into the countryside, delivering the kind of programs that spoke directly to the people's needs. The party was working hard and skillfully to win over the underprivileged, he worried. Sukarno Prabowo, the son of farmers in a village in central Java, remembers the impact of these programs very well. Sukarno, not to be confused with Sukarno, the president, was born in 1946 in the Purbalingga Regency, the sixth of seven children, while the Dutch were still trying to crush Indonesia's independence movement. After Indonesia was established, his father got a bit of rice from the revolutionary government, and their family worked a small plot of land. While his parents were peasants who spoke only Javanese, the young republic gave Sukarno a chance to study, and he took to it like a fish to water. You might call Sukarno something of a teacher's pet. He was the kind of kid who read the whole newspaper every day and organized extra classes for him and his friends after school. He absolutely loved studying history and politics, and by the age of 9, he was already following Sukarno's near-constant radio speeches. He was a huge fan, and the results of national elections. Short and solidly built with twinkling eyes, Sukarno was the kind of guy who rattled off facts and quotes and phrases from foreign languages, smiling the whole time, so excited he may not notice when others may want to talk about something else. He read the People's Daily, or Harian Rakyat, to him, and he started an extracurricular study group under a young member of the PKI, which was engaged in constant outreach in his town. The most important of the PKI programs in his region was carried out by the Indonesian Farmers Alliance, BTI, which sought to enforce peasants' rights within the existing legal framework and push for land reform. BTI members told Sukarno and his family that the land belongs to those who work it and it can't be taken away. And even more importantly, they surveyed and recorded holdings, made sure laws were enforced, and helped improve agricultural efficiency. Twice a week, Sokono and two of his friends got together for 3 hours with a man named Sutrisno, a tall, happy-go-lucky party member with brown curly hair, to study basic politics in the Marxist tradition. Sokono learned about feudalism and that the inefficient distribution of land his family lived under would be replaced if Indonesia ever transitioned to socialism. They studied the concepts of neocolonialism and imperialism and learned about the capitalist United States. Sutrisno told them about Khrushchev and Mao and the revisionist debate, but said that the PKI had chosen the peaceful path to power in the context of President Sukarno's revolution. Sokono could not afford to buy issues of Harian Rakyat, the paper Zane wrote for, so he'd go read it at the newsagent's house for free. As teenagers often do, Sokono got a bit obsessed. His love for left-wing theory suffused every part of his life. He and his friends would play soccer in the middle of town. There was no proper field in their small Javanese village, of course. And as they kicked the ball back and forth, he told himself he was learning important political lessons. Soccer was the people's sport because it was cheap, he would remember later. And sport builds the collective spirit. It teaches you to work with others, that you can't accomplish anything alone. I realized soccer taught me that if you have something you want to accomplish, you have to cooperate. The PKI claimed it was organized along Leninist lines, but it wasn't really. It was a broad mass party in its own terminology, growing far too quickly to maintain the strict hierarchical discipline Lenin himself argued for. The party had active members, or cadres, like Sokono's teacher, Sutrisno, who took a pledge to uphold party ethics, and it also ran a number of affiliated organizations, like the BTI, which were meant for mass civilian participation. The industrial counterpart to BTI was SABSI, the affiliation of union members that included much of the country's working class, whether they cared about Marxism or not. Then there was LECRA, the cultural organization which provided an essential service in small towns where there was little to do. It put on concerts and plays and dances and comedy shows, which would often go on all night and provide the best and perhaps only entertainment in town. Oh, everyone went, Sokono said. It didn't matter what your politics were. If it was happening, you had to come and watch. Broadly speaking, all these communist-affiliated organizations supported President Sukarno, though not uncritically. The Indonesian Women's Movement, or Gerwani, opposed the traditional practice of polygamy, which Sukarno embraced very publicly while president. Gerwani became one of the largest women's organizations in the world. It was organized along feminist, socialist, and nationalist lines and focused on opposing traditional constraints put on women, promoting the education of girls, and demanding space for women in the public sphere. In Sokono's part of Central Java, the women's movement was focused on the most basic of issues. A young woman named Sumiyati, who joined the organization as a teen in her village in Jatinum, was taught how to sing, dance, play sports, and most of all, defend feminist ideals and the rights of women to fight to destroy the shackles that bound them and our rights to learn and to dream. On the question of polygamy in general, the movement was uncompromising in its opposition. On the question of Sukarno's specific polygamy, it made compromises. No man is perfect, Sumiyati learned. This is a time of transition, and we have to struggle for the changes we want to see. We move forward step by step. We can't expect the world to turn over as easily as we turn the palm of our hands. At absolutely no point did cheerful, studious Sokono think his leftism made him a subversive. If anything, he was almost a nerd, a kind of overenthusiastic young fan of the country's revolution. The communists are the good guys, he often thought. They were doing well in elections and were friends with his hero, President Sukarno. In his studies, Sokono also developed a sophisticated understanding of the relationship between economic conditions and ideology. You see, the Communist Party in the United States never grew because it didn't have the right roots, he concluded. But in Indonesia, we have so much injustice and exploitation. There's a relation between the material conditions of our society and the ideology which flowers here, and injustice is very fertile soil for its roots to grow. By 1957, Indonesia's left already considered Washington an obstacle to the nation's development, if not an all-out enemy. But soon, things got much worse. Rebellions against Sukarno's government broke out on the outer islands to the northeast of Java and Bali, as well as on the island of Sumatra. The rebellions were both economically and ideologically motivated, demanding more control over the income from their regions, as well as the prohibition of communism, which greatly pleased Washington. Because the rebels had such good weaponry, people like Sukarno and his teacher believed the USA was helping them. "It's the strategy of divide et impera," he said, using the Latin for divide and conquer. "It is the Cold War," he said. "Let me explain. Cold War is the name they have given to the process by which America tries to dominate countries like Indonesia." Bombs over Ambon. As the Indonesian left became more certain that Washington was somehow behind the growing civil war, Sukarno's village received a copy of Harry and Rakyat with a cartoon on the front page. The headline above the illustration read, "Two systems, two sets of morals." On the left, the Soviet Union was launching something upward. Sputnik, the first satellite ever sent into orbit by humankind, which had been a fabulous propaganda tool for global communism all year. On the right, the United States was dropping something from the sky, bombs onto Indonesia. Howard Jones was working a stint in Washington as all this was going on until he got a metaphorical tap on the shoulder. President Eisenhower asked him to return to Indonesia. This time, he would be United States ambassador. And as soon as he got there, he had to face a government that was increasingly suspicious of the United States. Just days after Smiling Jones presented his credentials in March 1958, Sukarno's foreign minister asked to speak with him. Subandrio, a thin, bespectacled, and thoughtful diplomat who had tried to rally international support from London during Indonesia's independence struggle, asked the new U.S. ambassador, as politely as possible, to explain a cache of weapons that had been airdropped to the rebels. There were machine guns, Sten guns, and bazookas, and the weapons bore the mark of a manufacturer in Plymouth, Michigan. Jones said he didn't know anything about them and pointed out that U.S. weapons were available for purchase on the open market all over the world. Subandrio backed off, saying he did not want to imply that Washington was arming those who sought to break up Indonesia. Carefully and articulately, however, he would refer back to the issue several times, as delicately as possible. Subandrio was taking extreme care not to confront or offend the new ambassador. This is the stereotypically Javanese way of broaching sensitive topics. One dances around them suggestively, even with close friends, and this was a representative of the most powerful nation on Earth. It slowly became clear to Jones that the foreign minister was convinced the rebels were receiving external support, but he wasn't saying it outright. Finally, he did. Subandrio submitted that the Indonesians believed someone was behind the rebellion, but took his accusation no further. Jones knew his bosses were sympathetic to the rebellion, everyone did, but he had nothing to admit, and the meeting ended. Soon after, Jones met with Hatta, the second most important Indonesian revolutionary behind Sukarno. Like Subandrio, Hatta wore glasses and the flat peci cap, the Indonesian version of the fez, a very popular look among Indonesia's early revolutionaries. The two men talked about the logistics of the rebellion, and Hatta made it clear he shared Washington's commitment to fight communism. "But," he said, "this rebellion was an entirely different matter, and they considered it a threat to Indonesia itself." They finished the meeting, but just as Jones was turning to leave, he slipped the new ambassador a piece of information that spoke directly to his concerns. "From the standpoint of America, you could not have a better man as chief of staff of the Indonesian army," Hatta said, referring to General Nasution. "From your standpoint, Nasution is fine." "What do you mean by that, Dr. Hatta?" Jones replied. "The communists call me their enemy number one," Hatta said. "They call Nasution enemy number two." Jones had a revelation. "Then what has happened in Indonesia is that anti-communists are fighting anti-communists. Communism is not a major issue of this dispute." That was right. The army was perhaps the most anti-communist force in the country, apart from the most radical Islamists. A few of its top generals had even studied in the United States. As the rebellion dragged on, protesters began to gather in front of Jones's ambassadorial mansion, convinced the U.S. was behind the rebels. The New York Times had Washington's back, lambasting Sukarno and his government in a May 9th editorial for doubting assurances the U.S. would never intervene in the conflict. Jones dealt with the protesters as well as he could, but the rebellion was not happening in the Capitol, where things were mostly comfortable. The fighting was raging to the west, on the large island of Sumatra, and on the smaller islands to the northeast. Most crucially, planes were circling over Ambon, the home island of Francisca's family, and dropping fiery death onto its residents. Day after day, bombs fell onto Indonesian military and commercial shipping vessels. Then, on May 15th, the explosions hit a market, killing both morning shoppers and Ambonese Christians attending church. On May 18, 1958, the Indonesians managed to shoot down one of the planes, and a single figure floated slowly toward a coconut grove. His white parachute got caught in the branches of a tall palm tree, where he was stuck for a moment, then he fell to the ground and broke his hip. He was quickly found and captured by Indonesian soldiers, who probably saved him from being killed on the spot by furious locals. His name was Alan Lawrence Pope. He was from Miami, Florida, and he was a CIA agent. Howard Jones didn't know it, but Frank Wisner's boys had been actively supporting the rebels since 1957. The two men and their differing approaches to fighting communism had come into direct conflict. After Wiz returned from sick leave in 1957, he had warned the Dulles brothers that the rebellion would be an unpredictable, potentially explosive affair. They ignored his concerns and gave Wisner the authority to spend $10 million to back a revolution in Indonesia. CIA pilots took off from Singapore, an emerging Cold War ally, with the goal of destroying the government of Indonesia or breaking the country into little pieces. They chose not to tell Howard Jones's predecessor, John Moore Allison, about the covert action because, as Wisner put it, the plans might elicit an adverse reaction from the ambassador. Instead, they transferred him to Czechoslovakia and brought in the oblivious Jones. Jones was brought back so that he could keep smiling to the Indonesians while another arm of his own government dropped tons of exploding metal onto small tropical islands. Jones noticed that the Indonesian newspaper Bintang Timur, Eastern Star, came up with a nifty drawing to illustrate this posture. They drew John Foster Dulles in a boxing ring. On one of his gloves, they wrote, "Goodwill Jones," and on the other, they wrote, "Killer Pope." Throughout the course of the CIA's history, this dynamic would often be repeated. The agency would act behind the back of the diplomats and experts at the State Department. If the CIA was successful, the State Department would be forced into backing the new state of affairs the agency had created. If the secret agents failed, they would just move on, leaving the embarrassed diplomats to clean up the mess. That's what happened with Jones. For reasons we still don't understand, Alan Pope was carrying identifying papers when he was captured. He was put on trial, and he became a very potent symbol of U.S. involvement in the rebellions and apparent proof that the Indonesians, especially the left, had been right all along. Even so, Ambassador Jones received orders to issue categorical denials that the U.S. had controlled any missions that impinged on Indonesia's sovereignty, including Pope's. Not long after, Jones was authorized to offer Indonesia's prime minister 35,000 tons of rice if the government took positive steps to curb communist expansion within the country. Taken together, it was a carrot-and-stick approach, but with the stick very poorly hidden. The 1958 operation in Indonesia was one of the largest in the CIA's history, and it was patterned on the successful coup in Guatemala. In other words, it was exactly what the People's Daily writers such as Zane had been worried about 4 years earlier as they carefully reported on the events in Central America. But this one failed. The Indonesian army put down the rebellions, greatly increasing their power within the country as a result, and no more U.S. military missions were uncovered. Sukarno, of course, felt deeply betrayed. He put it in very personal terms. He said, "I love America, but I'm a disappointed lover." Jones did not enjoy the position that Wisner's CIA operations put him in one bit. Reflecting later on the tragic, absurd failure of the operation, Jones turned back to the nature of his country to find an explanation. Washington policymakers had not been privy to all the facts, nor really grasped the inwardness of the situation, but had proceeded on the assumption that communism was the main issue, he wrote. This was the all-too-common weakness of Americans, to view conflict in black-and-white terms, a heritage no doubt from our Puritan ancestors. There were no grays in the world landscape. There was either good or evil, right or wrong, hero or villain. Jones stressed that the Indonesians only turned to the communist bloc for economic and military aid after they had exhausted their attempts to get the same kind of help from America. In 1955, the Soviet Union had offered substantial aid, but Indonesia, pursuing a strictly neutral position, said it wouldn't take any more than the Americans offered. Even then, the government hesitated, unsure if it should take anything from the Soviet Union at all, until 1958, the year Alan Pope and other CIA operatives burned Indonesians alive when they took it. The playbook that Wisner's team had developed in Iran and Central America had failed badly in this much larger country, one that was playing a fundamental role in global affairs. In the most credible way possible, Washington had been exposed in Asia as an aggressor against one of the world's leading neutral powers. Very little of this made the news back home, but people in the Third World knew. Frank Wisner began to act increasingly erratically toward the end of 1958. Sometimes he would appear too excited, talking too quickly. Sometimes his eyes would just glaze over. Back in Georgetown, he saw a psychiatrist. He was prescribed a generous dose of psychoanalysis and underwent shock therapy. Jones, along with the U.S. military attaché in Indonesia, took Sabandrio's advice. He emphasized to Washington that the United States should support the Indonesian military as a more effective, long-term anti-communist strategy. The country of Indonesia couldn't be simply broken into pieces to slow down the advance of global socialism, so this was a way that the U.S. could work within existing conditions. This strategic shift would begin soon and would prove very fruitful. But behind the scenes, the CIA boys dreamed up wild schemes. On the softer side, a CIA front called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which funded literary magazines and fine arts around the world, published and distributed books in Indonesia, such as George Orwell's Animal Farm and the famous anti-communist collection The God That Failed. And the CIA discussed simply murdering Sukarno. The agency went so far as to identify the asset who would kill him, according to Richard M. Bissell, Wisner's successor as deputy director for plans. Instead, the CIA hired pornographic actors, including a very rough Sukarno lookalike, and produced an adult film in a bizarre attempt to destroy his reputation. The agency boys knew that Sukarno routinely engaged in extramarital affairs, but everyone in Indonesia also knew it. Indonesian elites didn't shy away from Sukarno's activities the way the Washington Press Corps protected philanderers like JFK. Some of Sukarno's supporters viewed his promiscuity as a sign of his power and masculinity. Others, like Sumiati and members of the Gerwani women's movement, viewed it as an embarrassing defect. But the CIA thought this was their big chance to expose him, so they got a Hollywood film crew together. They wanted to spread the rumor that Sukarno had slept with a beautiful blonde flight attendant who worked for the KGB and was therefore both immoral and compromised. To play the president, the filmmakers, that is, Bing Crosby and his brother Larry, hired a Hispanic-looking actor and put him in heavy makeup to make him look a little more Indonesian. They also wanted him bald, since exposing Sukarno, who always wore a hat as such, might further embarrass him. The idea was to destroy the genuine affection that young Sukarno and Francisca and millions of other Indonesians felt for the founding father of their country. The thing was never released, not because this was immoral or a bad idea, but because the team couldn't put together a convincing enough film. West New Guinea. After the Alan Pope fiasco, relations between Indonesia and the United States also took a nosedive, and it was Jones who was left to save them. With characteristic energy, Sukarno quickly set to work on befriending the cheerful new ambassador. After just a few months, in October 1958, Jones and his wife invited the president to their bungalow on the Puncak in the mountains in West Java for a small luncheon. To their surprise, Sukarno showed up with 80 security guards and 20 drivers and promptly set about charming two American Marines accompanying Jones. They feasted on chicken and beef satay, vegetables and mangosteen, papayas, mangoes, and rambutan, and the president asked for some music and dancing. Sukarno requested fast Molokan rhythms, that is, music from Ambon and the surrounding islands, the ones the CIA had just bombed. Soon, the Americans and Indonesians were all whirling and sweating and moving to the sounds of kettles, which they all were banging with their spoons and bayonets. The budding friendship helped to put the attacks of 1958, which everyone knew were not Jones' fault, behind the two of them. But that wasn't the only issue threatening the U.S.-Indonesia relationship. Decolonization was far from finished in Southeast Asia. When the Dutch finally gave in to the revolutionaries in 1949, they ceded control of most of their territory to the young republic, but they did not give up their claim to a giant piece of land to the east of Java and north of Australia. That is, the western half of New Guinea, the second largest island in the world. Indonesia, as it stood, was already an incredibly diverse country, but the people of Papua or New Guinea are visibly different both physically and culturally from people from the other islands. They are darker-skinned, with curly hair, and the Dutch colonial administration had barely penetrated into their territory. The Dutch never had the whole island. The eastern half, now Papua New Guinea, was controlled at the time by Australia. To Sukarno, the issue was incredibly simple. The Dutch had absolutely no business being anywhere but back home in Holland. Indonesia was a democratic, multi-ethnic national republic. Race didn't matter, and neither did Papua's level of economic development. For years, his government in Jakarta tried to negotiate with the Dutch to no avail. Then, from 1954 to 1958, Sukarno argued the case at the United Nations. At home, this meant organizing protests and creating as much pressure on the Netherlands as possible. Washington, not wishing to alienate the Dutch, important Cold War allies in Western Europe, neglected to back Indonesia's claim. For the Indonesians, this was an issue of national pride. It was so crucial that at the end of 1957, the Indonesian government, frustrated with 7 years of being ignored, expelled all the remaining Dutch citizens from the country. This was always going to be a blow to the economy. After only 8 years of independence and just the beginning of a public education system, Indonesia had not trained everyone needed to run the enterprises set up over centuries of colonialism. Francisca remembers that by the time the Dutch left, her library and her social life became Indonesian-dominated for the first time. Her country had been transformed radically in less than 2 decades, from one where she was part of a minority of brown students sitting in a white classroom to one where she was running a library entirely with fellow Indonesians. This was the world where she would raise her young children, and she now had 3. In naming them, she and Zane mixed local traditions with their international ideals. The first, they named Damayadi Nanita. Damai means peace in Bahasa Indonesia. The second, Francisca wanted to name Candide after the famous work by Voltaire, which she had devoured in Europe. So they named the child Candida Marana. The second name, which Zane chose, included Mir, the Russian word for peace. Peace was becoming a theme. The third child, their first son, took the Christian names Anthony and Paul from Francisca's family tradition on the Moluccan Islands. Then they expanded them to Anthony Palmiro so that once more their son would carry Mir, or peace. They were among a new group of Indonesians, the first ever born in the country. Around them in Jakarta, a whole generation that had been raised on the values forged in 1945 was coming up. Students, workers, and regular people of all stripes had been rallying against imperialism in all its forms. Jones was dealing with them right in front of his home. Benny Widyono, a well-to-do economics student, found himself in one of these demonstrations while attending college in Jakarta. He joined a crowd, which carried him into Lapangan Bentang Square, a new name, it was previously Waterloo Square, and was electrified by the movement taking place all around him. The people were standing up for themselves and demanding full independence. They weren't asking the Western powers, they were telling them. Benny's parents, who had quietly built a business under Dutch rule and had suffered under Japanese occupation, never could have imagined that just over a decade later, Benny would be out in the streets openly protesting imperialism in Jakarta. Howard Jones traveled throughout the entire country, asking Indonesians if they really cared about the issue of Papuan independence from the Dutch. The answer was unequivocal. Yes, they really did, but that wasn't going to change Washington's position. He recounts that locals came to him time and time again and asked with genuine mystification, "We just don't understand America. You were once a colony, you know what colonialism is, you fought and bled and died for your freedom. How can you possibly support the status quo?" After over a decade representing the United States in Asia, Jones had no answer. The behavior of the United States lent weight to the charge, he realized, that we had become an imperial power ourselves.